On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we discuss the incredible NL West. Four of the best teams in baseball reside in that division. We discuss where they go from here and how far back will the Rockies finish. Then we have a special guest. It's Buster Olney of ESPN. We talked to Buster about the New York Yankees then and now, how much they have changed over the years. And then it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly, of course. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks the Colorado Rockies have a chance in the NL West. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And the secret ingredient is believing in yourself.
The secret ingredient, Jake Mintz, is Clint Hurdle. We are going to talk about the Rockies hitting coach situation later. Will that turn their season around? Fangraphs tells me there is a 0.0% chance that that will be happening. But on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast, we are going to talk about the NL West and maybe also the Rockies who are in that division, as this division has just surged out of the gate here in 2025, four of the best teams in baseball. So we're going to talk about that. We have a special guest. It's Buster Olney of ESPN. You know Buster Olney. He's been talking about baseball for a long time. He's going to join us to talk about the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Mets, the big teams. You know some of those teams that you're quite familiar with. And then it's Friday. The good, the bad, the ugly. I am always looking forward to that at the end of the week. And we have another good edition once again. But Jake, as I alluded to, our opener today is the NL West.
Whole lot of wins here.
Yeah. Let's set the stage. The NL West, a division that was quite active over the offseason. Even the Padres snuck in a couple moves at the end before opening day. We know what the Dodgers did. We know the Giants going out and spending big on Willie Adames, Justin Verlander, Buster Posey is in charge now. The Diamondbacks bringing in Corbin Burns, making some other moves. And here we are, 3 weeks into the season, and these four teams have the four best records in the sport. The Padres are 15-4, the Dodgers are 14-6, the Giants are 13-6. The Diamondbacks, after sweeping the Fightin' Fish in Miami this week, have won five in a row. They are 12-7, tied with three other teams, the Mets, Yankees, and Rangers.
But I want to interrupt you. Yeah. I want to interrupt you because I really want to emphasize what you just said.
Yeah.
Like you said it and it's good that you said it, but I just want to say it like three more times.
Yeah.
The top four records in the league are in the NL West.
Also, the worst record.
Think about like what that means and the worst record, which allows for the best records.
More on that in a second. This is really kind of amazing. Even with this small, 3 week sample, there are so many parts about this that are impressive. There's the fact that the Dodgers have the worst run differential of them by a lot. And I know part of that is that Cubs ass whooping last Saturday that really kind of ruined their run differential. But the run differentials kind of support these here, right? Padres, best in the sport, plus 37. Giants, third best, plus 32. D-backs, plus 22. Dodgers, plus 7. It's not like these teams are just fluking their way through one-run games. Like, they look like four of the best teams in the sport. Maybe they are not the four best teams in the sport. I got my power rankings coming out today through three weeks, and they are not 1, 2, 3, 4, but it is not that far off. What have we learned about this division? Because I think we had varying levels of optimism for these teams. I know I was higher on the Padres than you. We were both skeptical of the Giants. It's not like we were having some bold takes believing in the Dodgers, and the Diamondbacks kind of fall somewhere in between them. So have we actually learned anything different? I mean, there's a few ways we can evaluate the degree to which this start has changed the way we're looking at this division, and we can kind of get into that. But for more broadly, has anything actually changed for you in the way you're looking at these teams?
A couple different things. I think at this point in the season, you have to evaluate player performance rather than team performance. And it's trying to pick out what's real, what's not. Obviously, it's sifting through the haze to find what matters. And I think that's easier to do on an individual level because that data can be supported by some sort of change in a player's process, mechanics, whatever. So like the Padres, right? Fernando Tatis Jr. looks like he's going to be a top five MVP candidate. He looks as good as he's ever looked. If that's the case, and I feel good about that being the case moving forward, that changes functionally how I think about the San Diego Padres. I think that is similar about the Arizona Diamondbacks and Corbin Carroll, right? Where there was some question heading into the season, okay, is this a 3-win player, a 5-win player, or a 7-win player? And it certainly looks like a 7-win player. And so that, I mean, that's 4 wins, you know?
Yeah,
it could be. That kind of changes the way I think about the Diamondbacks, as has the hot start Josh Naylor has been having, right?
Yeah, man.
That changes the way I think about them. And then in terms of the Giants, I would probably say that player is Jung-Hoo Lee, who we have spoken quite a bit about. They're the team that I remain the most skeptical on because of, like, Mike Yastrzemski is not going to have an OPS over 1,000, right? I think now, Willie Adames will kind of pick some, pick up and it'll even out, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I would say, heading into the season, I ordered these teams, Dodgers, Padres, Diamondbacks, Giants. I feel good about that order. However, I think that they're all a little bit better than I thought. I don't have a single team in this division to getting a wild card spot, right?
You didn't.
My wild card, I did not. My wild card spots were the Phillies, the Mets, and the Cubs.
Yeah. I think it was Cubs or Brewer. Yeah, I think because you still picked Brewers. Winning the division. It was Cubs. Yep.
I remember my picks. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had gone with the Braves, the Padres, and the Diamondbacks. So I was more in on San Diego for sure. And then Arizona, I was on to the last day between the Diamondbacks and the Mets. And right now you could still argue the Mets as being a better team than the Diamondbacks so far, but that's going to be close. I think to your point about like who's been the most impressive, statistically the most complete team, and the record reflects, is San Diego. I mean, they look, and one of the best. Fangraphs is an amazing resource for a lot of reasons, and we're going to reference them again here in a second when we talk about the playoff odds. But one of my favorite features when you go to their roster resource and you look at the depth charts is the team rankings, which is just like a quick glimpse at their hitting, their starting pitching, and their bullpen. And that is such a great way to kind of compare these teams in a very simple sense of just like, all right, these three elements of their team, where do they really stack up? And you can see that the Padres have essentially been good at all three elements so far. Their bullpen ERA, their starting pitching ERA is excellent. The Giants, their offense has maybe been better than expected. Their starting pitching ERA, and this is after another bizarre start from Jordan Hicks in the series finale against the Phillies, where he gives up like 5 runs in the first and then somehow gets through 7 innings. But their starting pitching ERA is 27th. Like that. And we thought that that could have been maybe a strength for them with Logan Webb, you know, with Robbie Ray, with Justin Verlander. Like I was higher on some of those veteran pitchers, but their bullpen has been generally fantastic. And then the Dodgers, we still haven't really seen them at their best. I mean, you look at them statistically and yeah, they have some standouts, but it's not nearly as balanced as you necessarily expect. And then with Arizona, once again, you have a nearly elite offense as last year. The bullpen has been way better than expected. The starting pitching, I think, has been generally disappointing, but still okay, but certainly not an obvious strength at this stage. And so when you factor all those things in, you certainly feel better about San Diego than the Dodgers, knowing that they have more coming. I think the other existential question about this division, before we kind of broaden out to a historical sense, is like, do you think this will be a race, right? I mean, we kind of looked at, everyone was like, all right, even if these other teams are good, we still expect the Dodgers to win by 10, 15 games. Whether it's two teams, whether it's three teams, whether it's four teams, is this something, and the easiest way is like, yeah, I mean, we just did this a year ago. We thought the Dodgers were going to run away with it, and they still had to fend off the Padres in the final couple weeks. Are we really going to be talking about this being this close at the top for the rest of the season? With some of the issues the Dodgers are having and how well some of these teams are playing, I feel like we might, but I think it's probably a little too early to say that.
In The Incredibles, the movie, the end. There's that scene where Dash is running a track race and his parents are like, go, go, go. No, 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 no. Run, run, run. Slow, slow, slow. The Dodgers, as an operation right now, are not optimizing to win every single regular season game, right? They are doing
not
things
at all.
For the, not even close. We just got news yesterday. I would argue actually not news, but yeah, Dave Roberts went on Jim Rohn's show.
Yeah.
This was somewhat frustrating that, like, we've been asking Dave Roberts this for months, like, when is Ohtani coming back? And he's like, oh, no, no, no. And then Jim Rohn asked him and he's like, not for a couple months. It's like, okay. I basically wrote this last week.
No, I know, I know, I know. It's just classic Dave Roberts. Like, as we've talked about, his honesty is so refreshing, but then also so random. Like, he'll just share very important news at very strange intervals, and this was a great example of that.
So, Ohtani could come back earlier if they needed him to. If Ohtani was on the Padres, like, he might already be in the rotation, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that that is a relevant data point, not to downplay what the Padres have accomplished or what I think they can accomplish, right? It's just I think the Dodgers are looking at the bigger picture because they can afford to do that. And because of that reason, I do think that this will be a race for longer than we expected. Because the Dodgers are, I mean, it might be like a little tortoise in the hare situation where the Dodgers might be too focused on the long game by the end.
Yes.
And the Padres could stay involved long enough. And that's almost what happened last year a little bit, right? A couple bounces go a couple different ways and the Padres end up winning the division. But I, as a person who wants to be compelled by all this, I think that's a good thing, right?
Oh,
I think it's a good thing. I want this to be a race. I don't want the Dodgers to run away with it. My question back to you is, are we discounting Arizona and San Francisco too much?
Well, that's part of this in terms of who's going to be really pushing them. And Arizona was there, last year too, for some amount of the season, as far as, you know, within striking distance. I think, and I'm going to fold in the updates to the kind of the Fangraphs for playoff projections here, playoff odds, because I think that's also sort of instructive. But to your point about the Dodgers and them playing the long game, I think that that's valid. At the same time, they don't want to get too cute with it, because at some point they don't want to end up in a situation where they are playing a three-game wildcard series, right? They still want to win the division. And so how far they can go while letting these other teams stack wins, bank wins, build potentially a lead in the division if it's the Padres' case, right? Like, they're going to end up in a situation where maybe, again, postseason we still feel is a certainty, but it is still, you don't want to be in a situation. I do wonder if the standings at some point do kind of force them into a higher level of urgency. So I want to bring the playoff odds in here for a second, because if you look at the Fangraphs playoff odds to win the division, the Dodgers were about 84% going into the season, and it's dropped to around 75%, but it's still comfortably ahead. But if you look at just to make the playoffs, all four of these teams are now over 50%, which is pretty amazing when you consider the Padres were at 35 to start the year, the Giants were at 29, Diamondbacks were at 59, and they've gone up to about 67. Again, this is early sample, and I know some people like to roll their eyes at the playoff odds, but it kind of just speaks to the kinds of wins that they've already banked and the positions that they put themselves in. And honestly, right, when the Braves are this bad and have started to make it harder on themselves to make the postseason, a team that certainly had a better chance, that's going to help all the other teams in the National League, not to mention the fact that we haven't seen, you know, the Brewers get off to an amazing start. I know they've played a little bit better this week, but the rest of the National League has, for the most part, not necessarily given reason to think that these teams can all think that they could make it. And that is what really makes this compelling, is the notion that we could get maybe even three teams, all four of these teams, into the postseason. It is technically possible, although I think mathematically it is going to be difficult for the degree to which they are going to be beating each other up.
One of my bigger concerns heading into the year about Arizona was the rotation.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's mostly been backed up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you go by rotation ERA, they are 23rd.
Yeah.
And it's happened in a concerning way where Corbin Burns has looked horrible, like horrible, horrible.
Big, and I just want to say the timing on that. He's pitching at Wrigley Field this afternoon. Big opportunity for him to kind of shut the haters up. But I agree. He's not been the $200 million pitcher so far.
Not even close. I mean, go to Savant and flip between 2024 and 2025 if you want to see red turn to blue. The track record there is enough that you would expect him to turn that around in time. I just don't think that this rotation is a strength. And I think that it was it is fine. Like, I think it's fine. I think it's solid to good. But I just don't think it is a needle-moving unit in the way that it was portrayed heading into the season. And I think that that is, in time, what could sink the Diamondbacks, even though this offense has impressed. As far as San Francisco is concerned, I mean, we got an email this week calling me a Giants hater, more or less, which, true.
Yeah.
Which, fair.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know what to do with them. Verlander's been, he's looked just cooked.
Not awesome. I mean, I don't know why Melvin left him out there for like five batters too long this week. It was a very strange week. And like this series split in Philadelphia this week was a great test. We talked about this earlier. We go, all right, Giants, like, go prove it. In some ways, they did. I mean, their two wins, like, they whooped the Phillies around. Does that say more about the Phillies? I don't know. But yeah, there's certainly parts of this team that have been disappointing and concerning. Maybe you project that those things get better because they can't possibly be this bad. Willy Adames certainly falls into that category for how slow he started. But yeah.
I would say another thing to keep an eye on, the two lowest bullpen ERAs in the sport right now are the Padres and the Giants.
And Giants, yep.
Mm-hmm. And those won't stay there. Teams do not have 1.89 and 1.52 bullpen ERAs.
Padres,
for
I mean, Padres are a pick to finish first. I mean, but yes, not that.
Sure,
low. Sure. Yeah.
But I just bring this up to say that's an area where things will come back to normal. When all is said, I just need to, because of how these Giants are built, I need to see more. Whereas for the Padres, like, I just watched this last year. Even with Arizona, I just watched a version of this last year.
Yep.
I need more time for the Giants. That's not like they've done anything wrong, right? I'm not trying to bury them for their own faults. It's just less of a proven entity. And for that reason, I am more skeptical. Let's pivot now, Jordan, to how this lines up historically, because I think it is really interesting.
Yes. And this is, we got an email from Brennan. This was a couple days ago, but still relevant. Brennan says, hey guys, love the pod. I was looking at the NOS standings today. Noticed the Rockies are somehow already 7 games out of fourth. And by the way, it's now worse than that. They're now, I think, 8.5 out of fourth as they have obviously lost again.
Can you just say that again?
Well, I'll correct it. Well, let me finish the email and then I'll say it.
Out of fourth.
Brennan asks, with how good the rest of the NOS is playing, how many games out of first and fourth place, respectively, do you think the Rockies will be at the end of the season? Okay. So the Rockies are 3-15. That's the worst record in baseball. They've lost 6 in a row. They have a minus 51 run differential, which is so far and away the worst in the sport. It is, I mean, I don't even think anyone else is. The second worst is the White Sox, and they're only at minus 22. So the Rockies, I know we took the over. I don't even remember what it was, but we took the over because we were like, it's the Rockies. They'll win a bunch of stupid games at home, and how bad could they be? Well,
bad.
We might now have the perfect storm of incompetence and excellence elsewhere in the division to where this is heading towards a very dark place. Now, with that in mind, as Brennan asks, what's possible here? You know, how low can they go? And we do have some recent precedent for seasons like this. Jake, you are intimately familiar with one of them. I have an extremely vivid memory of being at the 2018 World Series at Fenway Park. And on the Green Monster kind of manual scoreboard, they still, even though it's the playoffs, they still have the standings from the National League East. on the board. Yes. And I believe I have a picture of this, of you standing next to this. Okay. Anyway, I bring that up because that year, 2018, the AL East featured an all-time awesome team in the Boston Red Sox, who, of course, went on to win the World Series and were awesome in the regular season. They won 108 games, and the Orioles, truly, at the beginning of their epic rebuild, lost 115 games. And that year, the Orioles finished 61 games behind first place. They won 47, the Red Sox won 108. And they, I guess, to answer Brennan's question, that looks to be 26 games behind fourth place. Now, this is important because that year, the Blue Jays were also bad. So this was not four good teams and one bad team. This was three very good teams, one amazing team, two very good teams, and the Yankees and the Rays, and the Blue Jays won 73. But 61 behind first place, like, to put that in perspective, I believe the White Sox last year were only 51 back, I think, 51 and a half. Okay, so it's like you need historic excellence at the top in addition to historic disaster at the bottom if you are going to reach 60 games behind first, and that's what 2018 gave us. So the question is, if we get that from the Dodgers,
gave us as a gift.
So the question is, it's hard for me to imagine getting to 60 games back again. And part of it is because the rest of this division seems so good that it might prevent the Dodgers from getting to 110, 115 wins, right, the way we said, oh, maybe if everything clicks, it goes. So with that in mind, I mean, again, there's some other recent precedents. The 2021 AL East, the Orioles had 52
wins. So there's
wins,
two different things
there
here.
There were 490 win teams. That's probably a better
There's two different comparison. Things here. There's the gap between the bottom and the top, and then there's the overall excellence of the division, right? And I think those are two separate things to monitor about the NL West right now. How bad are the Rockies? How far does the bottom drop versus how good is everyone together? So 2021 AL East, total wins, I was looking at that this morning, total wins in the division was 449, which, as far as I can tell, going back to like 2000, is the record for a five-team division. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were years where the six-team NL Central got sure, over that sure, because they, you know, had the Astros in it.
Yeah.
This 2021 race, Rays at 100, Sox at 92, Yanks at 92, Jays at 91, O's at 52. It is when your fourth-place team is winning 91, that's how you get to that level, right?
Yeah.
And I think that this group will not get there because I remain, to my core, a Giants hater.
Yeah. And then again, like in that season, the Orioles, that was 48 games behind first place and 39 games behind fourth. So that is 39 behind fourth. I don't know. I think that's the best comp. I mean, that's really what they're kind of going for here. That is the division to kind of match is the 2021 AL East. And we will see how far the Rockies fall and which team emerges. Like at this point now, I am really compelled by how many wins it will take to win this division. That is now something I'm very, very intrigued by. Even if that's just between the Padres and Dodgers, even if that means, you know, it's three teams, if it's one team, even if the Dodgers do end up emerging as the obvious favorite, that intrigues me a lot.
I think the biggest thing that has changed my mind about this division is that the Dodgers will not end up with some mind-boggling uber historic total of wins. That to me is the biggest change. Like before the season, we looked at the roster and we were like, and other people were like, 123 wins?
I said 109, I think was my pick. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that now, because of the quality in the division and how much the Dodgers will have to play those teams, reevaluating that ceiling is the biggest shift that I've had to make.
Last question, and then we will take a break and return with Buster Olney. as we alluded to earlier this week, your bold prediction that the Rockies would go 0-13 against the Dodgers. I mean, let's open it up. Who's to say they won't go 0-13 against the Padres? Who's to say they won't go? Like, how many division wins will this team collect? They are already 0-6 to start the year against the NL West, having been swept by the Dodgers and the Padres. What do we think?
Dude, 0-52 in division. Oh my God. What's the over under? 11?
I think I was actually going to set it slightly below that.
Division again, wins.
Guys, folks, we can't doubt Coors. We can't doubt Coors Field. Coors Field will ruin this in some form at some point. But division wins out of 52 division games, I'm going to say 10. I'm going to say 10.
Okay. Let us
what
know.
What you got? Put it down. Yeah, what's your official prediction?
I'm going to take the over on 10. Okay, I'll take the over on 10. A hilarious bold prediction would be the Rockies don't win a game against the Dodgers and win the season series against the Giants.
Mm. Yeah. So again, just like last year, just context, last year they went 4-9 against the D-backs. They went 3-10 against the Dodgers. They went 8-5 against the Padres. And 3-10 against the Giants. So that was like the 18. Difference between the Padres, you know, not winning the division last year was they couldn't beat the Rockies. Anyway, I don't think that's going to happen again this year. Okay, enough NL West chat. There is our NL best opinions. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we will talk to Buster Olney about the New York Yankees. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are joyed to be joined by the one and only Buster Olney of ESPN. If you're listening to this, you know who Buster Olney is. Like, I don't need to explain that to you. Buster, when you meet someone new and they ask you what you do for work, what is your response?
Baseball writer. You know, that's... They'll ask me, you know, the immediate reaction is, boy, that sounds like fun. And then I'm able to say I'm pretty much doing exactly what I wanted to do since I was 15 years old.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. And we certainly can relate in a fraction of a sense. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've been doing this for not nearly as long, but we also feel fortunate to get to talk and write about baseball for a living. But Buster, we really wanted to lean on your institutional knowledge here in this conversation today, because the state of baseball is one, especially coming off the offseason, we're still fresh into this 2025 regular season. And there's been so much discussion about the inequities, the differences, the powerhouses of baseball, certainly on the coast in terms of the Dodgers and the Yankees. We just had a Dodgers-Yankees World Series. And as someone who wrote a book about the Yankee dynasty, something that now for us, since it's been so long since we've seen the Yankees actually win a World Series, we're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah. Remember when the Yankees were doing that? But there are a lot of people listening to this show that have not lived or really were conscious through the Yankees' dominance. We wanted to kind of talk. Yeah, us for the most part, right?
We were six
sure, in 2001, we remember a little bit of, but for the most part, the Yankees being that dominant force, it was not the thing that we've gotten used to since we've been covering baseball. And so we wanted to kind of have a big picture conversation about the Yankees and about these powerhouse franchises and how they compare to that Yankees dynasty. So Jake, where do you want to lead us in this direction?
For people who have not read your book about the Yankees dynasty, titled Last Night of the Yankees Dynasty, can you give just like a big picture synopsis of it for people?
So what happened with the Yankees is that when George Steinbrenner was suspended for stuff he did in the late 80s, he was suspended from baseball. And within that vacuum, Gene Michael and others in the Yankees organization built this tremendous farm system that wound up yielding Derek Jeter and Andy Pettit and Jorge Posada, Bernie Williams. And by the mid-90s, that group of players ascended into the big leagues and was joined by players that the Yankees got through their spending. And, you know, guys like, you know, Cecil Fielder in 1996, you know, signing David Cone as a free agent, signing David Wells as a free agent, later trading for Roger Clemens. And so you had this incredible combination of homegrown players and, you know, great stars that they added through free agency. And the fact that at that point, because they were so successful, they have what the Dodgers have now, which is a lot of players coming in from the outside saying, I want to be a part of that. That looks like fun. And you had Joe Torre as manager. You had Brian Cashman at the beginning of his time as general manager. And it's, in my mind, you know, it's one of the greatest teams ever. 1998 Yankees right now, the best team ever. And maybe the last dynasty that's going to win four World Series in 5 years.
Now, let's start with that idea of a dynasty in modern baseball. I think that there are various arguments that can be made about the Astros and the Giants in the 21st century. Now, I would probably argue against both of those personally, but one could make a reasonable claim that those are dynasties. Why do you think, though, it is so difficult nowadays to accomplish such a sustained run of success like the Yankees had in the late 90s?
Keeping the players together, first off, collecting the talent. I should start with that. Collecting the talent and then holding that together is really difficult. Not only because of finances, you know, a lot of baseball fans will focus on that, but it's also about luck. It's about injuries. It's about players who, you know, decide to depart. And it's about, I think, the competitive spirit of a group also holding together. You know, that Yankee team that I covered in 1998, they had lost in the playoffs to the Cleveland Indians, and they came into 98 so motivated. They were just driven, and they had this incredible season. And then year after year after year after that, it got harder for that group of players to push the rock back up the hill. And, as you know, I was standing on the field on Sunday with Dave Roberts, the Dodgers manager, and David Cone was in this conversation. It was our Sunday night group. And Coney was talking about that, how it becomes harder for players to, you know, keep doing going through the same challenge year after year after year. And Dave was nodding. Like, I think the Dodgers can feel it. You know, they have a great team. We projected them coming into the year. Maybe they could win 125 games. And Mookie's getting older. And Freddie Freeman's getting older. And injuries are manifesting. And all of a sudden, they look a little older. And all the criticism that the Dodger players had about the Yankees defense last fall, now we're starting to see in the Dodgers a little bit. So holding that sort of dynasty where you're going to be in five World Series in 6 years, win four World Series in 5 years, that's really hard beyond the dollars.
And I'm so glad you bring up the Dodgers there, because that's the obvious place to kind of take this conversation. I do want to spin it back to the Yankees as to how they relate now, how they compare now to that time. But for the Dodgers, like after this offseason and these past two offseasons, even before they won again this past year, people are getting so far ahead of themselves and almost thinking like, oh, well, now they're just going to win the next five World Series. And like, this isn't fair. This is not fun for everybody else. And what my part is like, okay, maybe. I mean, the talent certainly suggests that they're going to at least be in position to do so. But it felt so premature to push that far ahead and be concerned that we are at a level to where this is going to turn fans off. But I also recognize that part of the conversation is not the actual result where the Dodgers win five World Series in a row. It's the perception that other teams don't have a chance to compete with them. Now, we've already seen already that the Padres and Giants and Diamondbacks they're right there, right? They're three of the best teams in baseball as well. But I guess when I spin it back as a question is like, do you view it like when are you surprised that we are now 25 years later and we haven't seen another repeat champion? Like, was there a point along the way where you realized like, oh, this is not something that we are going to see again for a very long time? Or do you think that there is a version that we could see a team get back to that level?
I think it's really tough for the reasons that I talked about. And I do wonder about the psychological effect on players. Again, going through the challenge, pushing the rock back up the hill year after year after year in this era of social media. I think it's clear that players get worn down by the constant feedback. You know, back in the 90s, you know, those guys could finish a game and go home and they were walled off around it from all that conversation. But now it's day after day after day. And I do think it takes a toll on players. I Look, I think the Dodgers, and I saw them in the first week of the season, on paper, that is the best team I've ever seen, right? The best collection of players. The idea that you could have three Hall of Famers at the top of your lineup and you know, guys who are just extraordinary players, and then a rotation depth. When we met with Dave Roberts before that game, Coney asked Dave Roberts, like, we think your rotation's pretty good, but who are your next five? That's really good, too. And he starts out, he goes, well, we'll get Shohei back, and then Clayton Kershaw will come back. And then we started laughing because it's absurd how much depth they have. The bullpen is, as one general manager said to me, it's like a whole group of closers and how good they are. But it's that challenge of, you know, not only overcoming injuries, but pushing the rock up the hill year after year after year. I just don't think anyone's going to replicate what those Yankee teams did.
I also think it's worth noting, right, the playoffs are longer.
By one round. Ways. You're 100% right. It's one more round, roll of the dice.
Right. It's just another roll of the dice. And I think that from a math perspective, that does matter. I want to actually pivot now to the Mets. Because one of the things that is clear in your book, even though the Mets are in the World Series in 2000, the Yankees run New York. And they still do to an extent. But it is clear, given how Steve Cohen, the Mets owner, has operated over the last number of years, that the grand goal of the New York Mets is to chip away at that, is to try and even the score to a point. Is that possible at all in any way in your mind? Can you foresee a world in 25 years if the Mets win four or five and Juan Soto is the most, you know, famous player on the planet and he's a legend, where the Yankee hat is not what it is now and the Mets hat kind of takes over the city?
Right. The question of which team owns the city. There was that time in the mid-80s where the Mets owned New York in a way that the Yankees didn't. The Yankees had regressed. I absolutely think it's possible because Steve Cohen, he starts with more money than anybody else. It's clear he's been looking for the right person to bring in and run baseball operations. He cycled through a bunch of different people, and David Stearns is really good at what he does. You know, I had a conversation last week with Jeremy Hefner, the Mets pitching coach, and I asked him, you know, it's clear because we spent all, you know, idiots like me spent all winter bleeding about the Mets pitching staff and its rotation. It's not going to be good enough. And it's clear from last year and this year that the Mets, David Stearns, are really good at identifying guys and making them better. And Jeremy said it's not, it goes beyond the numbers that, you know, we all can look at. You know, he said they're really good at picking, identifying pitchers with a growth mindset. Guys who come in are open to change and open to feedback. Sean Manaea, you know, this year, he mentioned Griffin Canning as a great example. It's Clay Holmes. I mean, when they signed him as a starter, I was like, what? The guy that we've seen that can't repeat his delivery is going to shift to start? No way, right? But they clearly are good.
I was there last night. I watched Griffin Canning strike out eight people in six innings, and I like could not believe what I was seeing. You know?
Right. Yeah, and that's what Jeremy's talking about. So if you have that combination of a really smart front office and behind the scenes, they're trying to build up this pipeline of pitching, and you also have a lot of money to spend, then yeah, they could become the next version of what the Dodgers are now, where you know, a great player development in addition to all the money and in addition to the fact that they right now have an excellent culture.
So spinning it back to the Yankees, this is kind of my last question. Also keeping it big picture, you know, I already asked, okay, how surprising is it that nobody has done the repeat winning before, or you know back-to-back championships, building a true World Series caliber dynasty. But just focusing on where the Yankees are and how they operate now versus, you know, under George Steinbrenner. Is it like the notion that the Yankees would even go as many years as they did without reaching the World Series? I know that finally ended last season. But how surprising is that? And what are, if you could sum up the most explicit differences between how the Yankees operate now and how they did 20 years ago, just for them specifically, not in the context of baseball, because we know baseball has changed around them, but how they choose to operate, what are the similarities and what are the differences?
Yeah, and Hal obviously gets a lot of criticism from, you know, old Yankee fans who remember George and think that George got every great player. And as I said to you before we got started, I think Yankee fans sometimes forget all the warts of George. The fact that when at times during his ownership, he was the biggest impediment to success.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know how his impetuosity would come into play. I think over time, Hal is growing into this role as owner. And, you know, I talked to Scott Boras about this after the Juan Soto negotiations. The idea that Hal Steinbrenner would offer $760 million 10 years ago, that there's no chance. Like, it feels like Hal is growing as an owner. What has not kept up clearly, or the difference between that team in the 90s and this one, is that consistent pipeline that really built the core of that dynasty. They haven't had that. Like, for example, last year when they had this really good team and they went out and tried to make trades in midseason, the response they got back from the industry on guys like Eric Crochet was, your farm system's really down. We don't have players we're interested in. We're going to go talk to other teams. That's the biggest challenge, I think, for the Yankees going forward, because they're always going to spend a lot of money. I think next winter they'll be the favorite to sign Kyle Tucker. I think he's going to be in the outfield for them next year, but they need to develop that steady pipeline of young talent.
Yeah, and I will say, too, 360 for Aaron Judge. Now it's like, well, duh. It's not that it was a tough decision to bring him back, but even financially, and I know he's older, and I know at some point presumably he will decline, but it's like you're going to that ninth year so that he can stay here right now. And obviously that is a decision that has paid off in such an amazing way and will continue to for at least the next few years. But anyway, yep. Jake, go ahead.
Yeah, the difference between Judge obviously gets compared to Jeter, right? Jeter was never this good. Like, not even close. Not to besmirch Jeter, but like, what we're seeing now is historic. It's generational. And I'm curious, this is my last question for you. I'm not saying you don't want to have Aaron Judge on your team. Like, duh, of course you do. But when the whole operation hinges on one thing so completely, on one player, one person, we saw what happened in 2023, right? When he missed a big stretch and it just kind of crumbled for them.
Yeah.
Like, do you see that as a big difference between the 90s Yankees and the Yankees today, where back then it was like, we have everyone is a four-win player.
Nobody right? hits 30 homers pretty much, except for Tino had one great season, but they didn't have this lineup full of guys hitting 50 homers either, right?
Right.
I think that absolutely is true. You know, that team had a ton of really, really great players. Where now it does feel like that you have Judge, and it's kind of like Jordan in the supporting cast, as they always referred to it, back with the Bulls. Yeah. And you're 100% right about Judge. This spring, ESPN did a, you know, top 100 list, and one of my jobs was to go around and ask players where we screwed up on our top 100 list. And I can't tell you, from Tommy Pham to Andrew McCutchen, Matt Olson, guys like that are looking at our list saying, you got Judge 4? Really? He just had the greatest season ever by any right-handed hitter ever. He had an adjusted OPS plus at 223, and you guys got him 4? I think that we in the media fans got fixated on how badly he did in the postseason last year and forgot just how great a player he is. And we're seeing it this year when he's been even better so far, even without Soto.
So I live here in New York and I'm around the Yankees all the time. And I crack up every time Judge, like, you know, goes 2 for 3 with a homer and a walk. And in the post-game scrum, it's like, what do you ask him? Like, it's just, he's done. He does this feels like every day, right? He takes a pitch on the outer half and he hits it 410 feet over the fence. And then you're just like, Aaron, like,
yeah, you did it again. How about that?
Pretty great.
you're gonna hit 60 home runs again. All right, sounds good. You know, we should not be taking any of this for granted, and I know the Yankees don't. But it is an interesting form of this team. Buster, I know you've got Sunday Night Baseball coming up. We got the Astros and the Padres. That is a spicy little interleague matchup. You'll be on the call with Carl Ravitch, Eduardo Perez, and David Cohn, three of our favorites. Thank you so much for joining us on Baseball Barbercast, providing us some context, some insight, and we'll have you on again soon. Thanks so much, Buster.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, good, bad, ugly. Those are three adjectives because we said so. It's our favorite segment of the week. One thing good, one thing bad, and one thing that reminds us of Dan Ugla, bizarre, wonky, off the rails.
Jake, this is kind of a notion I've alluded to on the show over the last year or so as this one player has emerged to become one of the best at his position. I spent years saying that there was one player in particular that was good. His name was Mike Zunino. I said, Mike Zunino is good.
Zunino.
Don't be fooled by Mike Zunino's batting average, because this is a catcher who catches. This is a catcher who hits home runs. This is a catcher who everybody loves having on his team, on their team. And now here we are, Cal Raleigh, somehow doing everything Mike Zunino did 10 times better and becoming arguably the best catcher in the sport, is now up to 8 home runs after homering again in a ridiculous baseball game in Cincinnati on Thursday afternoon. It's just astonishing. I just that he is doing, as I mentioned, it's like all the things I love Mike Zunino for, Cal's just doing them way better and all the time for 4 straight seasons. He's now kind of off to like a historic power hitting start for a catcher for a career. He's over 100 career homers now. And he's just, man, is he good? Good undersells it at this point. I mean, he's one of the best catchers that we have. So pretty cool.
I think that's the thing. Mike Zunino was good, and you had to bang the drum to get people to believe that. Cal Raleigh is obviously good, but because of the work, Jordan, that you did, people know that he's great.
Mm.
That's the difference. Yes. Cal Raleigh is great because Mike Zunino was good.
Getting emotional. It's true, but it's a good way, because now we're past the point where people are like, well, who hits, who's 16? Who gets, like, no, we get it. He's awesome. So, yeah, I mean, he's well on pace for a third consecutive 30 homer season as a catcher, which that is not a thing that really happens. So Cal Raleigh's awesome. Very simple. What's your good?
The Milwaukee Brewers have called up a Washington University Bear, the school at which I attempted and, you know, sometimes played college baseball, has another big leaguer, Caleb Durbin, who was dealt from the Yankees to the Brewers in the Devin Williams trade, did not make the team out of camp, has been called up to join the Brewers in Milwaukee for his big league debut, and I did not play with Caleb. He showed up 2 years after I graduated. But I set the stage, baby. You're welcome, Brewers. No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. To know that a person who spent so much physical time in the same place as you did is now going to spend so much time in a place you never will, which is the infield dirt during big league games, is humbling and mind-blowing, and I'm so happy for Caleb and for the program. That means so much to me. And to know how, like, small school Division III baseball is better right now than it ever has been before because of the democratization of baseball development, the gap is still enormous. And to know where Caleb was playing and to know where he is now, it's remarkable stuff.
Yeah. And those who have listened to our show for a while now know he was on. This is a podcast guest becoming a major leaguer. Mr. Durbin, as Jake is showing off, is the class of 2017 Wash U Bears. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that lovely photo. But yeah, it's awesome. The Brewers are playing the A's at home, which is also important, right? Caleb, a Chicago native, I'm sure will have plenty of family in attendance. We'll see if he is in the starting lineup. If he is not starting against... I know it's Severino on Saturday, but I imagine he'll be in there certainly against Jeffrey Springs on Sunday at the very least, facing lefties.
There's awesome gonna be a whole army of
Yeah.
A whole army of thick neck Durbins making the drive up from the Chicago suburbs.
Yes. So very excited for him. And we'll see what happens. We'll see what this looks like. Caleb Durbin is a big leaguer. What a
go Bears.
Yeah. And if you haven't listened to us, we had him on over the offseason, and it was an awesome conversation. So we encourage you to go back and check that out. All right. It's time to do some bad. So Jock Peterson. Jock Peterson is 0 for his last 3, 4. I don't know. It's a little many.
I don't know. You picked it.
Many, many at bats. I think it's 35 plate appearances. This is not going well. He is still batting third for the Texas Rangers. What is most concerning is I was like looking up like, oh my God. And I just fell down the rabbit hole of like remembering all these hitless streaks. Chris Davis, the most famous one, that's the one. Although the thing about the Chris Davis one is that stretched 2 seasons, right? So he finished 2018 and then he opened 2019 with like another 10 or 12 hitless games. But I found some other notable ones, which I had either not known about or forgotten about. So Chris Davis had broken Eugenio Velez's record. The funny thing about the Velez one is that finished his career. So like went like 0 for 40 something, and then he's still looking for another major league hit, which is
he's still looking for a knock.
Another one that I found that I did not know about, and maybe this was a thing at the time, is Craig Counsell went like 2 months without a hit in his final season with the Brewers. Now he wasn't starting every day the way that Chris Davis and Jock Peterson have been. But the reason what's bad about this and just this concept, the reason why I fell into the rabbit hole is that Brandon Marsh is also in the same funk. We've got two players right now in 0 for 30 pluses. And I know, again, it's not really historic until you get to 40, and I hope neither of these guys get there. And both of them had very different expectations from an offensive standpoint coming in here. But yeah, I it's very different because Brandon Marsh is batting ninth and the Phillies don't need him to do anything, whereas Jock Peterson, they just gave him a bunch of money and they're still batting him third. So Rangers still did fine this week. They swept the Angels. But Jock, we were just like perfect. This could not be a better fit, and it has thus far been very, very bad, and that bumps me out because I like watching Jock succeed.
Eugenio Velez finishing his career 0 for 46.
Yeah. Yep.
Do you think he ended up playing a bunch more years in the minors and
Yeah, he was in Lidome,
Mexico.
I think,
right? He recorded another hit in life.
he hit but the ball and reached first base. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think he like wakes up in the middle of the night and walks down to the kitchen to like get a glass of water and just has like flashbacks? Dude, just still searching for a hit.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't think I'm not worried about that for Jock Peterson and Brandon Marsh. I'm just saying 0 for 30s are rare and we have two of them going on at the same time. So that is why I'm highlighting it. What's your bad?
My bad is RFK, not the ballpark.
Oh.
Which is good.
That was also pretty bad, but good for us when growing up going to the 2005 Nationals. Go ahead.
Rank your least favorite baseball related RFKs. RFK, who is the secretary for the Health and Human Services Department.
Junior. Different one.
RFK Junior,
not
thank
named
you.
After him.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Not yet. He was giving a press conference about autism and said the following quote, these are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted. Now, besides this being preposterous and insulting, which I don't need to explain to many of you, this filtered into our world due to the one part of they'll never play baseball. Let's just get this out of the way. Not true. Not true. Autism, neurodivergence is a spectrum. There are many people in baseball who I'm sure are on the autistic spectrum. How many of them have been diagnosed or have talked to their friends and family about it? I don't know. I can't say. People can assume and play games and try and do investigations and whatever, but we don't know. However, what we do know is that one of the best players in college baseball this year, a gentleman by the name of Ryland Zaborowski at the University of Georgia, has been very public at points in his career about being diagnosed with autism. And there are a couple of interviews that you can go watch from when he was in summer ball and a good article from when he was at Grand Canyon University earlier on in his career, where he talks about having autism and how it's impacted his life and how he's found success on the ball field, not in spite or because of it, just also. And he is tied for the lead in the SEC with 16 home runs and presumably uses the toilet unassisted as well. So this is just a reminder that, you know, this was a stupid thing to say.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, like, I understand that because of the quote, everyone's like, oh, it's easy to start speculating or thinking like, well, of course, like, oh, look at all these players. But like, no, this is a very real life example, someone who is succeeding at a very high level and being very open and vulnerable and in a way that is cool and inspiring. And so I'm excited for more people, because I remember reading about Zaborowski a couple of years ago. I saw him play in person when he was at Miami, Ohio. He's a very impressive physical athlete, big hitter, but now he's doing it for one of the best teams in college baseball, a team that might go to Omaha. Like, this is a story that will continue to be told. And now that he kind of has that exposure, I think that that's pretty cool. Yeah. And obviously the circumstances here is bad that we're talking about it because of this, but it is a cool story that we can highlight nonetheless.
I know it's a different sport, obviously. Tony Snell, who was in the NBA, I believe, was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and was very public and outspoken about it. Maybe, but RFK knows that. Maybe he was like, if you have autism, you can't play baseball, but you can hoop.
Yeah, surely that was, you know, definitely part of his calculus for this speech. Yeah, that's a very, very generous interpretation. Let's go to Ugla. My Ugla is a rather, you know what? Screw it. We got to talk more about the Rockies. The Rockies fire their hitting coach. I was going to do something else, but let's just do this. I teased it earlier. The Rockies fired Hensley Mullins.
Jordan?
No. Yes.
Can you look at the document from which we do our podcast, maybe?
Oh,
and
you,
not
are
steal
you doing...
someone's Ugla?
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. I apologize. I jumped ahead. You can do Bam Bam. All right. I'll swerve back to my Ugla.
Go ahead.
Which is way, way less funny. Landon Roop. Are you familiar with Landon Roop? A little more NL West chat.
Sure.
This is Giants an on-field pitcher. Ugla. I just think that this is cool and something that I appreciated that I saw this week. Landon Roop against the Phillies this week threw 56 curveballs in one game, which
colors
is exactly okay. Thank you. You had the right response. This is Ugla because you just do not see this ever anymore. Curveballs are now, I believe, only account for like 7% of total pitches in baseball, which is steadily declining over the last half decade. And Landon Roop is like, screw it. I am just throwing my best pitch 56 times in one game. From what I can tell, there's really little. The only pitchers that have thrown a pitch, the curveball that much in a single game are Lance McCullers, are like soft toss and lefties like Drew Smyly and Wandy Rodriguez in the pitch tracking era. Rich Hill, of course, has thrown a ton of curveballs in the game. But I would love to have Landon Roop stick in the rotation and just go all in on a pitch that nobody else thinks is good enough anymore. I think that's awesome. I saw him do this in spring training and I was like, wow, I want this. This is different. So Landon Roop, I don't know if you're going to be able to stick in this Giants rotation, but if you do, I hope you keep throwing a ridiculous amount of curveballs because they're cool. They're fun. They're fun to look at. That's my Ugla.
So my Ugla is that the Rockies fire their hitting coach. The Rockies rule so hard. I mean, fire their hitting coach. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we're not happy. This is not, we shouldn't be laughing. You know, Bam Bam lost his job here. However, we should note that Bam Bam almost lost his job a year ago.
Yeah.
When he was investigated by the FAA.
Let's give some context, Jordan. Hensley Mullins, who was the Rockies hitting coach, was relieved of his duties, which is a hilarious way to say it. You fired. And the Rockies named Clint Hurdle as their hitting coach for the remainder of the season, which is ugly in and of itself. Clint Hurdle, formerly
yes,
the
that's
manager.
That's the ugly part,
it's Clint Hurdle who is this now. Clint Hurdle, who I would not describe as a modern hitting mind. I told, I will forever be the person that informed Nolan Arenado of this happening yesterday at Citi Field when he was walking by me on the field. And I was like, hey, did you hear the news? And he was like, whoa. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, huh. And I was like, yeah. Clint Hurdle is not someone that 29 other teams would hire as a hitting coach. And I think I'm just going to kind of leave it at that. As far as Bam Bam goes, Hensley Mullins, whose nickname is Bam Bam, I'm just going to read the quote from Rockies GM Bill Schmidt as to dismissal. We haven't produced defensively. It's been a struggle so far. Yeah, 3-15. We're looking to change the voice a little bit here with Clint, which, by the way, is hilarious that, like, that's the change. He's, like, been around. And I have nothing but respect for Bam Bam, his work ethic and his knowledge as a baseball person. I wish him nothing but the best. We just needed to change direction a little bit with the offense to get it going. See, here's why I hate this quote. We needed to change direction a little bit. Last year, you didn't want Bam Bam to change direction when he was in the cockpit. And now you change direction. And for those of you who remain confused, it's time to bring up the best story in the history of baseball. This is from an April 19th article in 2024, almost a year ago today, from Thomas Harding at MLB.com. Mullins apologizes to Rockies after cockpit incident, since deleted social media video led to FAA safety investigation of United Airlines. This is when Bam Bam got into the cockpit of the team flight and then posted a video to his Instagram of him flying the plane, which is so illegal.
And literally investigated by United, FAA, whatever, because you can't just have random folks flying airplanes. Anyway, you have the story up, so please read the quote from Bud Black so that we can wrap here. get better than this.
Bud Black, Rockies manager, quote, Bam Bam, he apologized. I can't comment any further because there's what's being called an investigation of the matter. As far as Bam Bam goes, he apologized to the Rockies organization, to United, to the team. A spokesperson for United Airlines issued the following statement. We're deeply disturbed by what we see in that video, which appears to show an unauthorized hitting coach in the flight deck at cruise. No, it just says person. In the flight deck at cruise altitude while the autopilot was engaged. So this is another problem. Bam Bam is flying this plane on autopilot. Was he coaching hitters on autopilot?
We need a little bit more hands-on approach. And Clint Hurdle is here to bring it.
You know what I need? I need a photo of Clint Hurdle in the cockpit flipping the bird. Like,
I'm
kill
the
captain now.
I'm a Rockies legend. I took the Rockies to the World Series. That's the thing. I mean, that is a thing. You can't take that away from him. Anyway, I hope Bam Bam gets a job somewhere else, and I hope he stays away from the cockpit. All right. Well, that was a funny
flight
podcast.
School.
Yeah. That's funny. It's like, you know what? Actually, my true passion is flying planes so that I can be an authorized person in the cockpit. All right, we're done. That was a great podcast. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Buster Olney for joining us. Thank you to TJ Brossel and Carter Singh for co-producing this episode. Appreciate it, guys. We will be back on Monday with more Baseball Barbacast. But until then, you can email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Everyone have a good weekend. Talk to you soon. Bye.